the only lines any non-Hindu could ever quote from the Bhagavad Gita are from Robert Oppenheimer. He said, after the Trinity test, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. Could I give him a chance and his colleagues to reverse that and be able to say, now we are become life, the saviors of our world?" That's the Oppenheimer alternative.
That's Robert J. Salyer, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Robert J. Salyer is one of only eight writers in history to have won all three of science fiction's highest awards, the Hugo, the Nebula, and the John W. Campbell Memorial Award. He's a member of the Order of Canada, the highest honor given by the Canadian government, and he's the past president of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. He joins us to talk about his latest book, The Oppenheimer Alternative. Rob, welcome to the program.
Dan, thank you so much. It's been a while since we've spoken.
Yeah, great to talk to you about this new novel, which is, you've described as a sort of an alternate history, but maybe a secret history. But it's firmly grounded in the real story of the development of the atomic bomb. Tell us about what inspired you to write this novel.
Absolutely. Well, there are a number of inspirations. A stew is made from many ingredients. Number one, of course, is this is the 75th anniversary of the birth of the atomic age. July 16th will be the 75th anniversary of the Trinity test. August 6th, the 75th anniversary of the very tragic bombing of Hiroshima, and 3 days later, the bombing of Nagasaki. And an author, as a fiction writer, you're always looking for some way to make your fiction relevant. A science fiction writer, in some ways, even more so. Yeah, but why should I read that today? So that's reason one. Reason two is that I studied English literature as a minor at university, and they told me there that all great literature is about redemption, about people turning their lives around and coming back to being accepted in the public eye, or patch up a bad friendship or marriage or whatever it is. And as I thought about the great scientists of history, because I'm a science fiction writer, I'm inclined to think about them, who never had a redemption story? And, you know, we live today, and it's funny because I said to my nieces about three or four years ago, "You're lucky. You didn't live through this era of thinking that you might die in nuclear hellfire." Well, guess what? With rogue nations like North Korea and so forth, we're back in that era. So Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, J for Julius, Robert Oppenheimer, came very much, as did most of his colleagues, to have regretted starting the effort and ultimately culminating in the only ever use against actual human populations, the creation of the atomic bomb. He never got his redemption story. In fact, even worse, he was branded a communist during the McCarthy era of U.S. politics, stripped of his security clearance, which meant he could no longer consult even for the United States government, and died a horrible death from lung cancer or throat cancer, and just in misery. And I thought, is there a way to give this guy and the others a secret history, or an alternate history, as you say, a path to turn around Oppenheimer's most famous statement, which was the only lines any non-Hindu could ever quote from the Bhagavad Gita are from Robert Oppenheimer. He said, after the Trinity test, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. Could I give him a chance and his colleagues to reverse that and be able to say, now we are become life, the saviors of our world?" That's the Oppenheimer alternative.
So you have given them in your alternate history a chance for redemption. So tell us a bit more about the plot. What are readers going to find here?
Sure. In our history as it is known, Of course, the atomic bombs were dropped in August, the end of summer of 1945. Well, these guys, Oppenheimer included, almost all of these people, Edward Teller, Enrico Fermi, Hans Bethe, the great scientist Leo Szilard, who worked on the atomic bomb, were university professors. They had jobs to go back to, and quickly, because right after Labor Day, of course, the academic year starts up. So in our history as we know it, they just dispersed. They basically had their moment of glory in the media for, in theory, having stopped the war. And then they went back to the four corners of mostly the United States to teach. And my alternate history says, well, what if they were presented before the end of the war? They became aware of a natural catastrophe that would destroy the world by 80 years later, by the year 2030. The world would be destroyed if science didn't find a solution. And so instead of going back into teaching wherever they taught, they stay together in the Oppenheimer alternative after the war, these greatest minds ever assembled, and tackle a righteous project, namely saving us from environmental disaster, in hopes of, as Edward Teller said, he said, there's no hope of saving our souls. But the others thought, if they believed in souls at all, maybe they could save their souls if they turned it around.
Part of what sets your book apart is, unlike some alternate histories that introduce fictional characters into the drama, you haven't done that. These are all people who existed and were part of this history. So I'm curious about what kind of challenges that posed for you when you came to the point of having to deviate from what is known into what might have been.
You're absolutely right that it was an enormous challenge. And I'll tell you what spurred me on. Michael Crichton had a posthumous novel published called Dragon Teeth, about two of my favorite characters, the feuding great American paleontologists of the Old West days of the 1800s, O.C. Marsh and Edward Drinker Cope. They were larger-than-life characters. And here's the novel. I'd been thinking about writing one about them myself, but if Crichton had done it, that's fine. Here's the novel I've been waiting for decades. Well, what happens is Crichton puts one of them in the first chapter, the other in the last chapter, and all the many, many other chapters in between are entirely fictitious characters. And I said, you know, Michael, even for a dead man, you have been lazy here. You haven't done the work. People who want to read about historical periods want to read about real people. There was a TV series called Manhattan that lasted a couple of years, close to a decade ago now, set at the Los Alamos Laboratory. And it was about completely fictitious characters who worked on the Manhattan Project. And again, I thought, that's giving yourself a get-out-of-jail-free card. Nobody who is an expert on this subject can ever say to you, well, nobody really did that. I wanted to pass muster with the world's greatest experts on the Manhattan Project. So that was an enormous challenge. And you used the word secret history in the intro. I wanted to do it in such a way that even the things that deviate from what we actually know to have occurred could not be gainsaid from our historical record. There are all kinds of gaps or lacunae in the historical record involving these characters, and great hints that they were involved really, and honest to God truth, was something super secret. Oppenheimer said it himself to a journalist, if you dig behind this story, which at the time was his security clearance hearing, you will find there's a much bigger story than what you think is going on here. He actually really honest to God said that. I wanted to write that actual real honest to God. As far as anybody knows, nobody could prove by historical contradiction the story of that bigger project that Oppie and the others were involved with.
Another one of these hints that maybe there was something else going on that we still don't know about is one of his colleagues wanted to inform the president what a big mistake it was for Oppenheimer's clearance to be taken away, but unfortunately he didn't get a chance to deliver that message.
That's right. The man's last name was Parsons. And so in one of those puns that people like to make on people's last names, he was always known by his nickname, Deke. Deke for short for deacon, which is similar to a parson, blah, blah, blah. Deke Parsons was Oppie's associate director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. And when the federal government said they were going to strip his security clearance, Deke Parsons said on the record, my God, this is the worst thing the president can do. I have to tell Ike not to do this. What happened? Sadly, for, you know, there's no, I wish there was some evidence it was nefarious. It would suit my plot even better. There's no evidence that it was nefarious. He just had a massive heart attack and died before the president of the United States was able to be told this is a huge mistake by the McCarthy-esque Bork Hickenlooper, who was the actual senator who was hounding Oppenheimer. You know, the things Oppenheimer had worked on during the Manhattan Project were so secret that they weren't known to Congress. They weren't known to the Senate. When Truman was sworn in after FDR died unexpectedly, the vice president of the United States, who had become automatically the president, had to be briefed about the existence of the Manhattan Project. It was so secret that even the vice presidential level was not security clearance enough to know about it. So when a man like Deke Parsons of sterling reputation said on the record that Eisenhower had no idea what was really going on and should be told so that he doesn't allow the leader of what's going on to be destroyed, that's historical fact.
And leaves open this huge mystery. What was it?
Exactly. What was it? And of course, as a novelist, you like, as they say about fiction, Dan, they say the problem with fiction is it has to make sense, right? Nonfiction can be as crazy as you want it to be because, hey, well, that's how it happened. But you're always looking for resonances and callbacks to earlier things and things that make a tapestry that seems to naturally unfold. So when I was looking for something that Oppenheimer could be involved with after the war, the natural starting place was to look at what he was researching before the war. Everybody, if they can say any one thing about J. Robert Oppenheimer at all these days, and it's, you know, 75 years since he was world famous and over 50 years, 53 years now since he passed away, it's that he was the father of the atomic bomb. And therefore, they say he's an atomic physicist. He was not. He happened to be, just like so many things were when the war started, he was co-opted for another job, just as a General Motors plant was co-opted to not make cars and to start making airplanes in World War II. He was co-opted from astrophysics, from the study of stars. He was an expert on the biggest things, not the smallest things in the universe. And in fact, he was the man, along with a grad student named Hartland Snyder. He and Hartland Snyder were the two guys who came up with the notion of black holes. He would have been, if Oppenheimer had been remembered by history and there hadn't been a war, it would have been for the discovery of the black hole. That's all eclipsed by what he's remembered for now. So I set about looking for something that tied into what he did before the war, something involving stars, the sun, not nuclear fission, which is what powered the atomic bombs, but nuclear fusion, which drives the stars in our universe, and found something that I thought, you know, readers will agree or disagree, reviewers will have their say, we'll see, but I thought was an elegant tie-in, something sensible for Oppenheimer to continue to be involved with after the close of World War II.
I'm talking via Skype with Robert J. Sawyer about his latest novel, The Oppenheimer Alternative, and one of the things that impressed me about this novel is how you were able to bring these scientists, Oppenheimer, Fermi, Einstein, and others, to life in this novel. And I'm curious if learning about their private lives and personalities have given you a new appreciation for what they accomplished.
It really has. You know, we tend to think the world will be a great future when all of our great scientist brains are preserved in jars and we can ask them questions, right? You know, in the year 2500, we'll go and Einstein's brain is preserved in a jar and just run some electricity through it and say, hey, Albert, solve this problem for us. We forget that the 3 or 4 pounds of Einstein that was his brain were attached to 100, and by the time he was dead, 200, a bit corpulent, pounds of something else, of hormones, of raging emotions, of libido. And Einstein had a big one, as did Oppenheimer. These are human beings. Oppenheimer, by anybody's standards, except the fact that it never seemed to affect him, would have been a raging alcoholic, you know, a five martini man a night kind of guy. These were guys who were so human, so passionate in their love affairs. The spine of my novel is the love affair between Robert Oppenheimer and the woman he wanted to marry, but who kept spurning him, a psychiatrist named Jean Tatlock. These guys were emotional basket cases, but incredible geniuses. They could see the finest order and structure in the universe and yet lived enormously chaotic lives themselves.
You had to do, I can't even imagine how much research for this novel. And I'm curious to hear a little bit more about how you incorporated that research in. I understand you were able to even use some of the dialogue or the recorded conversations of people and work that into your novel as well.
That's right. Now, I said in 1953, Oppenheimer had a security clearance hearing that he lost because of his communist associations. But he had been identified by the United States government as a communist right back to before he had been asked by the military head of the Manhattan Project, General Groves, to lead the project. And everybody said to Groves, this guy's a commie. And Groves said, I don't care. He's the brightest and best organized man I've ever met in my life. I want him. But of course, the security people immediately started bugging Oppenheimer's, not just his office, but his home. And the word we use today, surveilling, following, tracking him wherever he went. So his famous thing that got him in big, big trouble is that he left the super secret Los Alamos headquarters of the Manhattan Project in the desert of New Mexico, contrived a fake reason to go to Berkeley, California. He was going to pop in to see Ernest Lawrence, the head of the what we now call the Lawrence Physics Laboratory there. And really, he was going not to Berkeley, but to San Francisco for a hookup with his mistress, Jean Tatlock. This really happened. And of course, he was tailed. Every aspect of that meeting was recorded by security men, the fact that he stayed the night and what time he came out in the morning. All of his conversations, including the big fight he eventually had with his wife over this terrible indiscretion, were recorded. And now either the actual magnetic tape still exists, and often cases they do, although as you use a radio band, know there's a finite life too to poorly stored magnetic tape. But even if the tapes don't exist, they were transcribed and the transcripts still exist. So I had reams of material that were Oppenheimer's actual words. And although there was no television during the Manhattan Project, no broadcast, real television, there was in his later years, there are interviews with Oppie, with Edward Teller, with Albert Einstein, with Leo Szilard. You can listen to them talk, hear the lilt, the rhythm, the accents that they spoke with, and try to capture that in prose fiction, which is what I undertook in the Oppenheimer Alternative.
And now that you have completed this big project, what's next for you?
That's a very interesting question because, you know, Oppie lived to be 67. As we speak here, this particular month is the 7th anniversary of my younger brother passing away. And I turned 2 months ago 60. So if I'm only going to live as long as Oppie, which I certainly hope I'll live a lot longer, he smoked himself to death, and I'm a non-smoker. I'm at a retirement age. If this is the capstone of my career, and I've been very fortunate that a number of the reviews have said, I just got one from France that said, this is Sawyer's masterpiece. From Amazing Stories, the world's oldest science fiction magazine, founded by the man who gave us the word. Amazing Stories, Hugo Gernsback, after whom we name our top award, the Hugo Award, said, this is my favorite Sawyer novel of all. So it's a hard act to top, Dan, and I'm taking my time. This book took 4 years to write, and as with most books, came out about a year after it was finished. If I start a book today, it takes 4 years to write, and it comes out in that fifth year, I'll be 65. A perfectly respectable retirement age. There may be one more book in me. I haven't decided what it is yet, but I'll tell you what's eating at my craw. That crappy Michael Crichton novel about Cope and Marsh. I think the world deserves a good one. So that, another science fiction historical novel, this time about the glory days in the Old West of frontier paleontology might be the next one.
Speaking selfishly as a fan who's read, I think, all of your books, I sincerely hope that this is not the last and that you will continue to write.
Thank you.
Rob, it's been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you for taking the time to discuss your new novel with me today.
My pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
Robert J. Sawyer's latest book is The Oppenheimer Alternative. You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. You can sign up for the Conversations podcast on iTunes. And you'll also find us on Facebook. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.